Welcome to a special weekend edition of the Bulwark Podcast. We're joined by a very, very special guest, David Axelrod, former senior advisor to the President of the United States, CNN host, and fellow podcaster. So,
yes, sir.
Thanks for coming on, David. So you're a podcast guy,
pleasure.
Aren't you?
I am. Yeah, I love it. You know, I started it sort of accidentally. I'm the director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, and we'd have guests, and often they were guests from the other party or a different point of view, and we'd have these good conversations that often delved into their backgrounds and their history and their personal stories. And someone at the IOP said, you know, this would be a great podcast. And I didn't really know what podcasts were at that point. And but I love stories. I think one of the ways we break down the silos that divide us is by understanding who we are as people. And I started this podcast called The Axe Files, which is now 351 episodes in, and a show on CNN. And now I have this a second one with Mike Murphy, who you know well, a Republican consultant, called Hacks on Tap, which is mostly about the 2020 race. I'm steeped in the podcast world now.
Okay, so who are the best guests and the worst guests? Who's been your favorite guest? It's like choosing between your kids or something.
It really is.
I guess what I'm getting at is that I put people in different categories. The worst guests are almost always politicians because they're so scripted and they're boring. And you know what they're going to say before you ask them the question. So has that been your experience?
Mostly, yes, because they are self-editing. And what this podcast requires is for people to be revealing. I just did one I really enjoyed with George Will, by the way.
Mm. Yeah, he's great. We've had him.
And he was very, very – it was a fun conversation. But, on both television and the podcast, a podcast with Sally Yates, the former acting attorney general. And everybody knew the backstory about her back and forth with Trump and so on. But what they didn't know was that her dad had committed suicide. And that's an experience that I also had, sadly. And we spent It was very emotional, and we spent some time talking about that. I try and have those conversations. I just did Harry Reid, who had the same experience, because it does define you in some ways, having had that experience, but B, because people need to understand that mental illness and mental health. Mental illness is not a defect of character. Suicide is not a defect of character. It is an illness, and we have to treat it as such. And people who are struggling with depression and struggling with suicidal impulses need to know it's okay to acknowledge them and get help. So every chance I get, I try and highlight that. I actually did Anderson Cooper's brother committed suicide. We had a really great podcast about his extraordinary life. But the people who are willing to dig deep and talk about those things. You know, in Harry's case, he grew up in this withering poverty, and his father was a belligerent drunk and would assault his mother, and he and his brother would have to subdue his father. And I mean, you know, these are things people don't know about public figures. And those are...
that is extraordinary. So all of you had fathers who committed suicide. That must be one of those defining moments of your life that you are always a person who went through that.
Harry said something to me, Charlie. Harry said something that was ranked so true to me, because when it happens to me, for me, I was 19 years old. I was at college. Knock on the door. Chicago police officer comes to tell me that the New York police had found my father dead in his apartment, and they needed me to come back to identify his body. And at that moment and throughout the whole experience, it is an out-of-body experience. It's surreal. Yeah. And Harry said, you know, you always think this happens to other people. this doesn't happen to us. It doesn't happen to me. And that's the way it felt. And then there are a lot of stages of guilt and acknowledgement after. And there was a long stage of denial. I didn't talk about it for 30 years. I finally wrote and then I realized the reason I don't talk about it is because somehow I thought it was a stain on my father's mm-hmm. memory, and maybe an embarrassment to me. It was a painful thing to acknowledge as well. And I thought, this is precisely why people don't get help. And I wrote a piece on Father's Day, I think in 2006, in the Chicago Tribune about the experience. And I've never, Charlie, gotten more of an outpouring of response than I did then. And it was heartbreaking and also uplifting to get these notes from people who would thank me for telling my story, because it gave them more courage to get the help that they needed. And that's what I always say to prominent people when I raise this, is that, you know, we can save lives by having these difficult discussions. So, I've had a lot of great discussions. I had a really interesting, speaking of fathers and sons, yeah. had an interesting discussion with Mitt Romney. I think I mentioned this to you when I saw you mm-hmm. last, but he was one of my early podcasts, and it was, you know, interesting to people because I ran, obviously, President Obama's, the message part of his campaign in 2012, and Mitt was on the other side of the ballot. But the truth is that we've become friends, as I did with John McCain after 2008. And I'll tell you another story about that in a second, which tells you something about Mitt Romney. But I asked, I told Romney that one of my childhood heroes was George Romney, his father, who was the governor of Michigan, a Republican, but a real champion of civil rights, which was difficult in the Republican Party in the 1960s. You know, Goldwaterism was astride the party and hostile to some of that. And then, of course, he became a critic of the Vietnam War, which cost him the chance to be the Republican nominee for president, in 1968. But he was outspoken. He was fearless, was willing to risk his career for the things that he believed in. And I mentioned this to him. And I said, what'd you learn from your dad? And Mitt Romney said, I learned to be cautious.
Really?
And I think the message was that, you if you are so outspoken, you can, you know, short circuit your career and your ability to do things. I've watched him lately, and I thought, yeah, his father would be proud, because it can't be easy to stand up as he's been standing up in the last few weeks and months to a president of his own party who is not at all shy about firing back. I think he's channeling his dad right now. But here's what I want to tell you about Mitt. 8 months after the 2012 election, I got an invitation to come to this conference that he has for his donors, supporters, for my wife and Susan and I to come, because I have a child, Lauren, now an adult, who has epilepsy, and Susan, and it's just a terribly debilitating problem. It robbed her of her childhood, almost robbed her of her life. My wife was so heartbroken and angry that there were no answers that she started a group called Citizens United for Research in Epilepsy, and which became the largest private funder of epilepsy research in the world. And the Romneys invited us to come and talk to their group about it. They could not have been warmer. The audience, which was full of people who, you know, I think on the face of it probably hated my guts, but received us warmly and heard our story. And some of them, including the Romneys, became generous donors. This goes back to my original point. There are things that we share that go beyond ideology, beyond party, things we share not just as Americans, but as human beings. And we've got to get back to that place where we can recognize those things.
That is the key, right, is to deal with each other as human beings, because what you're describing seems like something that is fading out of the world now, the ability to engage in really intense political struggles and debates and disagreements, but then still deal with one another as a human being, not see somebody as an entity or an institution or as somebody to be absolutely destroyed. You know, it was really interesting watching the reaction to the Ellen DeGeneres George W. Bush moment when they kind of became, I thought, kind of a litmus test or a Rorschach test of how people viewed all of that. I want to make a point up, though, when you were saying about George Romney learning that Mitt Romney learned to be cautious from George Romney, because I certainly remember back in 1968. When he basically derailed his presidential campaign, by saying that he changed his position on Vietnam, and he used the phrase "brainwashed," that he had been brainwashed, and of course that was
it was a poor choice of words.
It was a very poor choice of words. However,
I remember Charlie Eugene McCarthy said it must have been a light rinse.
Remember that? I think I told you that when I was 13 years old, I traveled around the state in Wisconsin with Eugene McCarthy, so I remember all of that.
But he had a droll wit.
But I've also thought about the fact that, you know, when you change your mind and suddenly you wake up and you think, okay, I had believed all of these things and maybe they were not true, I guess I have a lot more sympathy for him. Yes, it was a terrible choice of words, but the willingness to admit that, yes, I was wrong and my perceptions had been inaccurate, that is powerful. You know, you mentioned something a little bit earlier about storytelling. And I think this is something that you mentioned. You've had many extraordinarily interesting jobs, including working in the White House with the President of the United States. But you and I share something in common. We were both daily newspaper reporters.
Yes.
And I still look back on that as probably the most fun I ever had in any job.
Greatest experience of my life. And I've had great experiences. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Loved it. Loved, as you know, we're about the same age. Yeah. We grew up in the sort of end of the golden age of journalism. I got a job at the Chicago Tribune. I started working there as an intern 2 days after I graduated from college. And I walked into this big, ornate, bustling newsroom at the Tribune Tower, which sadly is now being converted for condos. But then there was this three-story newsroom. There was an observation deck above. And it was like right out of the movies. I mean, you know, there was just action going on everywhere. People, there was a sense of urgency and mission. There was a guy on the desk named Don Agrella, who was an old time newsman, and he was the assignment editor. And he would, if there was something breaking, he'd call your name and he'd say, "Axelrod, hat and coat." Mm-hmm. Well, nobody wore hats anymore, but that was from another era. But your pulse would race when you heard your name called, because you knew you were going out to be, you were being sent out to cover something exciting. In fact, the first day, Charlie, I came into the Tribune newsroom, I was a young kid. I bought a new suit. You know, I just so wanted to make a good impression. And I came in. And he called me over to the desk, and he looked me up and down, and he kind of smiled, and he said, "Nice suit." And I said, "Thanks." He said, "But it's going to get a little dirty. There were tornadoes in Lamont last night. We need you to go out there and cover the aftermath of it." And he was right. I mean, I was a muddy mess by the end of it. The next day, Charlie, he called me up to the desk, and he said, "Frank Fitzsimmons, who you'll remember, was the president of the Teamsters. He just voted himself a 400% pay raise or something at the Teamsters convention. I want you to go out and find some Teamsters and ask them how they feel about that." And you know, I'm 21 years old. Yeah,
if he had told me to jump, shell, right? If you were an introvert, that would be hard.
Oh my goodness! he told me to jump through a ring of fire, I would have done it, because all I wanted was a full time job at the Tribune. And I went out to some loading dock somewhere, and I was jumping on the running board of these rigs, you know, trying to interview these guys. And most of them were saying, are you freaking crazy? You want to get me killed? Get the out of here, you know? And but a few of them were so angry that they, and I just kept at it until I found people who were nuts enough to go on the record and complain. And I called in these quotes and I got back to the paper. We had an afternoon edition, called them into a rewrite, man. By the time I got back, you know, there was the Green Streak, our afternoon edition, and with my byline on this story.
Yeah, isn't that the best?
And it was such a great, I mean, I loved every minute.
You remember that. See, the people who have, you know, and again, maybe it doesn't exist anymore, but that adrenaline rush, the you know, dictating stories off the top of your head to rewrite
all
of those things.
Loved
seeing that
it.
Byline. And I see, my father was in the newspaper. So when I was a kid, I would go to, he worked at the Milwaukee Sentinel, which I later worked for the Milwaukee Journal. And I thought it was a daily miracle that this thing was written, edited, published every single day. And I really carried that into actually doing the job. And we had we were one of the last afternoon papers in the country.
Yeah.
So you'd sit there at 11 o'clock and you'd be dictating your story. And then you go to lunch and at 1:30, there it was. So you learned how to talk to people. You learned how to, you know, think very clearly. You learned how to tell stories. And I think that was the stories. But in terms of the preparation for the world, I think it was great. I think I probably learned things from being in the newsroom than any. I've had other good jobs where I've learned lots of things, but just the just that thrill. I also have to admit that I really had decompression after leaving the newsroom. There's a certain personality in the newsroom. There's a certain I would say roughness and toughness, it's like, this is not for snowflakes.
No way. Yeah.
And everything seemed boring after that. Okay, so I want to talk about some of your other jobs. And by the way, I wish we could spend a whole podcast talking about your dad and my dad and what it's like to lose a parent. You know, as I was thinking, my parents both died very, very suddenly, and I never got over it. And I just remember really struggling with trying to, you know, remember what was the last conversation we had? What was the last thing I said? And so there's so many issues to talk about. But let's talk about some other things here.
Okay.
And Kelly, so you worked in the White House. You worked next to Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, wish the White House is like West Wing. They fear it's like House of Cards, but it's probably more like Veep. So how do you characterize, what did you see there that people, you know, what do people who are on the outside, what do they not understand about what it's like to be president?
Well, first of all, let me just say what it's like to walk into the White House every day, at least as what it was like for me. And I suspect most people who work there, but you walk past those, Marine guards and, into the White House, and there is the sense and smell of history, there wasn't a day that I worked there that I didn't feel privileged to be there and to be a part of this history and to be a witness to it, it's really an extraordinary building. So let me just say that, and you can glean from this that I am, I believe in these institutions, and so that is part of it. I've always been, since I was a small child, you know, very transfixed by history and by the history of our democracy and the vitality of our democracy. So it was the, you know, epitome of all that to be working there. We also got there, as you'll remember, at a very difficult time. We walked in the door in the midst of a raging economic crisis and two wars. And so there was no honeymoon period for us. And what I saw was a president, and I think his was an extreme case because he faced the worst sort of dual crises since for an incoming president, maybe since Roosevelt. But being president, if you do it right, is a really hard job. Every minute of every day, you're confronted with really consequential decisions that can have grave implications for people, for the economy, for the stability of the world. And if you're doing it right, you bear that recognition. The night Barack Obama got elected, I went over to see him at the Hyatt Regency Hotel down in downtown Chicago, where he was headquartered that night. And my strongest recollection is walking in the room and seeing this guy I had known as a friend since he was a returning law student from Harvard. And there was a sobriety about him. There was almost a palpable, visible kind of acceptance of this burden, you know, that and you could see his face was sort of hardened as he, you know, and he, there was this recognition that of the responsibilities that he was about to assume. It was accentuated by the fact that even though he had had Secret Service protection throughout the race, now there were, you know, there was a phalanx of soldiers, and, you know, it took, you had to walk up two floors just to get to his suite. And, you know, so there, the heaviness of it was apparent.
You get the sense that that moment never really has happened with Donald yes. Trump, where he has the sense of the majesty, the history, the responsibility, and the weight of all this.
Yes. I mean,
we just passed, you know, 1,000 days, and you get the sense that that's just never going to happen.
Yeah,
that moment's never going to happen.
No, listen, you know, you and I have different views on many things. And I had different views than George W. Bush on many, many things. I have deep, deep concerns about some of the decisions that he made. I, never, ever thought that he made them for reasons other than that he thought they were the right decisions for the country. And in the transition from the administrations, he could not have been more gracious to us in terms of lending of advice and counsel about how the whole White House system worked. You know, my counterpart, Ed Gillespie, who you know well, invited me over to the White House, and we talked for hours about his experience. He showed me around. You know, the president invited President Obama and all the former presidents for lunch, for a candid off-the-record kind of conversation about the presidency. And I'll tell you something, Charlie, on the day that Barack Obama took office, I was summoned the night before. Rahm Emanuel, who was going to be chief of staff, called me and said, we've been with Chertoff all day, the Homeland Security director, and there is a very serious potential threat on the inauguration, and we may have to disperse the crowd. And I can't talk to anybody else about it. He told me to call him from a hard line. I did. He said, I need you to write a 60-second statement for the president, asking the crowd to disperse and follow.
Oh, my.
You know, and I need you to bring it to the speaker's office tomorrow, right before the inaugural ceremonies. And he'll put it in his pocket. If he needs to give it, the Secret Service will tap him on the shoulder, and he'll walk up to the podium, and he'll deliver this statement. So, which was mind blowing. That was, talk about your welcome to the real world moment. I stayed up all night listening to sirens in the night, wondering if this was related. And my wife and one of my sons were going to church services with the Obamas and the Bushes that morning. And, you know, I was instructed, you can't even tell your wife about this. And I so wanted to beg her not to go. Because I was so scared something would happen there.
And this is day one.
Day one. And so I walked over to the speaker's office. I had been doing some TV early in the morning. And I went over to the speaker's office, and the first person to come in was President Bush. And I went up to him, and I said, Mr. President. And he said, yeah, Axelrod. And I said, I've been on TV this morning. I've been talking about you. And he said, well, I don't watch TV, which is the lie that every president always tells. And I said, I said that the way you've handled this transition was an act of true patriotism, and we're deeply, deeply grateful. And he said, you know, Axelrod, I've been watching you. And now, which totally belies the notion that he doesn't watch TV. And he said, And I don't know whether he's going to punch me in the face or I don't know what. And he said, and he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, "You're all right." He says, "You're going to do well here." He said, "And I only have one piece of advice." I said, "What's that, Mr. President?" He said, "Just drink in every second of it because it's going to be the most exciting and interesting ride of your life." And I will always remember that moment, that kindness, you know, in that
thoughtful
moment. And, you know, my point is this. George W. Bush wasn't, he didn't do what he did in that transition because he loved everything that we said. We said some very harsh things about the way he had governed during that campaign. He did it because he saw himself as a trustee of these institutions of our democracy. And what bothers me about Donald Trump, I don't like his policies, but what bothers me is his utter disregard for the institutions of our democracy, from which he becomes more estranged every single day. He is tearing them down. Rather than protecting them and strengthening them, he is weakening them. And I find that alarming.
So we just passed the 1,000-day mark. So what has been the one thing that surprised you, that has surprised you the most? This is a hard question, I understand.
Yeah.
Because there are so many things.
Well, I mean, the level of his audacity. I, like others, labored with this sort of hope that the sobriety of the job, the weight of the job would in some way discipline or change Trump or soften some of his bad qualities. But he has shown no ability to absorb that. Everything is about him. Everything is about him. And, you know, Charlie, he's lived his whole life. His father told him, you know, I'm very big, you can see, on fathers and sons. His father told him there are two kinds of people in the world. There are killers and there are losers. And you have to be one or the other. I think that's how he's lived his life. And the fundamental message is there are no rules or laws or norms or institutions you need to respect. And the people who do are really suckers. They're losers. And the only thing that you can do wrong in life is not do that thing that is to your personal advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's raised this to the level of national policy. This is America's policy in the world. And, you know, the poor Kurds are the latest to feel the lash of that.
Yeah, the American unexceptionalism. I think the most shocking thing for me is not Donald Trump himself, because he is exactly who we thought he was going to be. What really is shocking, and this almost seems like old news now, is just the impact he's had on the culture and the willingness of Republicans to go along, his complete takeover of what used to be the conservative movement, his complete takeover of the Republican Party. And I think this is something you probably talked about with George Will, the shock of discovering that this movement that you thought you understood was much more paper thin, was much more fragile. And that the people that you thought had certain beliefs or certain ideas about character would just vanish. The fact that they would collapse in the face of Donald Trump's increasingly erratic, bizarre, narcissistic behavior. That to me is not only a shock, it's an ongoing shock. I mean, every time I open up Twitter and I see one other Republican just sort of rolling over, it's like, oh, the invasion of the body snatchers.
So, it's very sad. I mean, look, I want to see two strong, principled parties, and a vigorous contest of ideas. That's what democracy requires. I'm not one who wants to see annihilation, of one party or the other. But beyond that, I learned a long time ago. I mean, one of the things you learn when you work in Washington is that the self-preservation is the first instinct of a lot of the people who work there. I always say there's a reason Profiles in Courage was such a thin volume, I remember going down to talk to the Democratic Senate caucus with Obama, he was talking, I was riding with him before the vote on the Affordable Care Act. He gave, you talked about West Wing, he gave a speech that Aaron Sorkin couldn't have written. It was completely off the cuff. And it was, basically he said to them, you know, I've been thinking a lot lately about why I got into politics in the first place. And I think we all sort of share an experience. We got in because we thought maybe we could do something that would make an impact on our community, a positive impact that might help some people. And he said, now we have this opportunity to do this thing that will be remembered with Medicare and social. And he went, and it was really moving. People were in tears, and, you know, but there were people in the room who were in tears and clapping who still hadn't committed. And we went to the car, and he was looking out the window on our way back to the White House. And I said, you look a little pensive there. And he said, he turned to me and said, what are they so scared of? And I said, well, I think they're scared of losing their jobs. And he said, what's the point of being up here for 30 years if you never do anything?
Well, it constantly amazes me. So one of my concerns about Donald Trump is that even though his presidency seems to be imploding and the evidence of his unfitness continues to multiply, and I personally think that he's committed impeachable acts, he's not going to be removed from office. And my concern is that I do think it's possible he will be reelected because we do need two strong political parties. And I'm nervous about your political party, okay? I mean, obviously, I have a lot of feelings about my old political party, but I'm nervous about this. So let me ask you this. During the Obama years, during years in the White House, the Democrats, with the exception of his success, had kind of a wipeout, lost 1,000 seats across the country. Have, you know, watched as, you know, areas that used to be solidly Democratic were becoming more and more Republican, began to lose the Midwest. Do Democrats understand what happened? Do they understand why they lost all of those elections?
Well, I think that, first of all, let me say a few things about that. One is, we had a briefing in mid-December of 2008 on the state of the economy, and it was before the full recognition had set in on how deep a problem it was. And but so it was a shocking kind of briefing. And I walked out of there and I said to the president-elect, we're going to get our asses kicked in the midterms. It's impossible that we're not. One of the reasons, Charlie, I mean, I have, because of my child, my adult child with disabilities, and my wife stayed in Chicago, I told him at the beginning I could only stay for 2 years. But one of the other benefits of that was I knew that as the political guy, I would be invited to leave town after the midterms because it was inevitable that they were going to be a disaster. It, you know, the situation was in some ways exacerbated by what I thought was a pretty diabolically smart strategic move on McConnell's part to basically say, you've got these super majorities, you know, you take care of this stuff on your own. Because I think he recognized that if he, you know, Obama's whole message in 2008 was that we had to get beyond red state, blue state, work together and so on. And McConnell, I think, recognized if there were the, if there was a high level of cooperation that, that the Republicans would in some way, in many ways be doomed. And that, or at least that's what he feared. And he wanted to get seats back and he saw more, profit in conflict than cooperation. And that forced Obama into a more and more partisan, position. So there was all of that. But I also think that, you know, I have a home in rural Michigan. I really supported, the things that the president did in his second term, I supported the Iran agreement, normalization with Cuba, the Paris Accord, a lot of the thing I support, same-sex marriage. You know, I mean, there are things that I supported, but I often was wondered, and he was doing stuff on the economy, but not talking about it. Like, what is in this for my neighbors in Buchanan, Michigan? You know, what is it for you know, a lot of folks who are struggling and don't necessarily aren't really focused on Iran or Cuba or and so I think in that sense that was a messaging issue. And then we were so we were so underwater in terms of dealing with the economy and so on and trying to get reelected that we really focused on that. I think to the exclusion of building party at the grassroots and keeping in touch with the grassroots, and that was a big mistake. You know, all those legislative seats lost. Meanwhile, you know, you had the Koch brothers and others who were organizing feverishly in those states, and did a pretty good job of turning them, your state included. Mistakes were made. There's no doubt about it. But looking forward, I think it's important not to buy into the siren song of changing demographics, the notion that you can ignore large swaths of the country and, you know, just concentrate on maximizing the so-called Democratic base of minority voters and young people and women. I think that is a losing strategy. It was a losing strategy in 2016. I think it would be a losing strategy in 2020.
Well, that seems to be one of the central debates. And I think when we talked about this, I said, you know, I've been on a lot of panels on MSNBC where there have been folks who say there are no persuadable voters anymore. There are no independents.
Yeah, that's not true.
And that all we need to do is move hard left and turn out our hardcore base, and we are going to win. I guess my counter to that is, well, yes, but you understand that in the Electoral College, it doesn't matter if you win Burlington, Vermont with 90% of the vote, or
right.
if you get 75% of the vote in Berkeley, that's not going to help you if you don't get to 270. And,
right.
And so I do wonder whether or not, in terms of the cultural divide, I mean, what I hear every time, and you, I'm sure you hear the same thing, that if I talk about something like this to a Democratic audience, the three things I'm going to hear about are Citizens United and gerrymandering and a few other, you know, voter suppression, all of which are legitimate issues, but also feel like they're excuses for the fact that they stopped talking to a lot of people who are out there who are going to decide who the next president.
Yes. Look, I think it's dangerous. The polarization of our politics, which we can have a whole show's discussion on, is so dangerous because it encourages us to retreat to our silos and abandon people who are not necessarily of one or the other. I think that there are a lot of people in this country who are just plain exhausted, who understand that we cannot go another 4 years like this with a president who wakes up every day seeking to divide for profit and for his personal gain, and with, you know, crazy tweets and endless tantrums, fights that, you know, gratuitous fights that create nothing but chaos and make it difficult for us to get anything done. People understand that. This has been like a long national migraine headache, and people are looking for relief. And if you build a bridge for people to walk across, I think that there are people who voted for Donald Trump 4 years ago or didn't vote at all but are inclined to vote for the Republican candidate who would walk across a bridge and vote for a Democrat.
I completely agree with you. And I do think that, if Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980 by asking, are you better, better off than you were 4 years ago? I think a Democrat can be elected in 2020 by saying, can you take four more years of this?
Where you're going, Charlie. Go ahead. You ask your own question.
which brings me to this Democratic field. Joe Biden seems to be promising a return to normalcy. He may be Sleepy Joe. I'm totally okay if he sleeps through the next 4 years. But you also have the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that seems to want, you know, more revolution. You know, Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is now the front runner, and she's doing great, except for two things, which are policies and her personality. And I guess I want to get your take on that. I mean, the policies that she's, you know, not talking about, not answering the questions about raising taxes on the middle class, abolishing private insurance, taking positions that are going to put a lot of those voters' teeth on edge. So where are you at right now as a party on this question?
Well, first of all, let me say, give her her due, because she was left for kind of dead a year ago. People were saying, you know, she had the dust up about the Pocahontas thing with Trump. And there was this, and she wasn't raising money, and there was this sense that she was not really going to be a factor in the race. Well, she's run the best campaign of any candidate by far. She's the best organized. She has a coherent message. The message is integrated with her biography and her policy. And she's grown as a candidate. And that all of those things are leading indicators of a successful campaign. I do think she has work to do with working class white voters, non-college educated voters, African American voters, for whom she may be too much, the Harvard professor. She's better off being a Betsy from Norman, Oklahoma, than Professor Warren from Cambridge. And I think that the abolition of private insurance the total remaking of the healthcare system in 4 years is not a winning issue. It's not really a winning issue in the Democratic primary either. It's a winning issue among a segment of Democrats. But, you know, let me say parenthetically, there is a huge healthcare problem in this country. People are very concerned about the cost of healthcare. She's not wrong to want to address right. that. And she's not wrong to want to address the other issues that she's addressing. I was surprised the other night, and she was on CNN after the debate. We gave her ample opportunity to sort of, amend her position and just offer the possibility that she might offer her own more nuanced approach to this. And, you know, she didn't take the opportunity. Now, I saw the day after the debate, there was a report that she might, you know, I always thought that because she didn't have a plan for her own plan for healthcare and she was riding sidecar with Bernie, that the plan was to, for someone, which is unusual for someone who has a plan for everything else. I thought maybe she was holding out the option of having her own plan at the appropriate time that would supersede Bernie's plan. But I asked her on the air, and is this the plan you would introduce? She said, "I like that plan." Now that's not a yes, but I also think that you can't be as evasive as she's been on this much longer. I thought Pete Buttigieg, for example, and Amy Klobuchar kind of put her on the spot in a big way on that. And later in the debate, Biden, I still don't understand why Biden joined that discussion 2 hours after it began, but he was effective when he did. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you something on the from the Biden standpoint. It's not just his level of performance that's concerning, but you saw the cash on hand numbers, which are really important. Yeah, so $33 million for Bernie, $25 million for Warren, $23 million for Buttigieg, and less than $9 million for Biden. And that's not just a reflection of a cash flow problem; it's a reflection of an enthusiasm problem. And I think very worrisome from his standpoint. So, you know, I really don't know what's going to happen, but at current course and speed, you'd certainly have to rate her as the front runner right now.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit more about Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, because, you know, you were talking about building that bridge for folks. I think a lot of folks who are in that category were watching that debate and going, Lordy, there are moderates in the Democratic Party who make a lot of sense. Yeah. I thought that Mayor Pete had the strongest performance. I thought that Amy Klobuchar
was commanding,
had a really strong performance, whether
she did,
it's too little, too late. But so give me your sense of those. So you agree that they had
oh yeah, I mean, I said that
moments. Yeah.
Said that night. For Pete, he's been very articulate in these debates, very thoughtful. But what he hasn't been is commanding. And part of, especially if you're a young guy, you're not, particularly physically, prepossessing. You need to show command, and you do that by engaging with your opponents. And this was the first debate in which he did that, and I thought he did it to great effect. And I thought his moment, the greatest moment he had, was his moment on Syria.
Yeah, absolutely.
When he spoke from the standpoint of someone who had served in Afghanistan, and what this withdrawal and betrayal meant to the to the people who were serving there, and to the honor of the country. That was a commander in chief moment. I thought he did very well. Now the question is, I think he's doing very well in Iowa. He could be the surprise in Iowa. Right now, Elizabeth Warren has to win the Iowa caucuses because she's expected to. But you know, he could finish in the top three. Conceivably, could do better than that. You know, his challenge, frankly, is he hasn't been able to establish a following in the African American community. There is historic resistance, especially among older African Americans, to the gay community. And you know, he has to find a way to solve that problem, mm-hmm. and not just to win the nomination, but you better believe that if he were the nominee, that there'd be a lot of scurrilous stuff coming from
I was going to say this was an awkward question, but I think we need to go right into all of this, because the one thing we don't know is America ready to elect a gay man president? And
right.
Also, what would this campaign look like? You know, what we've seen is the willingness of Trump himself, but certainly his supporters, to be as scurrilous as possible, that they will. I mean, the racist
100%, yeah.
I mean, there's no question about it that the president knows what he is doing when he picks out, you know, the squad, that he knows what he's doing when he's going after African Americans and send her back and everything, that he's willing to play that. We've seen the you know, what they did to Obama with the birther thing. I actually started thinking the other night, can you imagine what a campaign would be like with the Republic, well, not the Republic, but the Trump world, you know, trying to run against a gay man? The ugliness of that. Now, it would be a clarifying moment, perhaps, but I wonder whether we're ready for that kind of a debate.
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah,
I really don't know the answer to that. And I think let's just stipulate that Donald Trump has no boundaries.
No boundaries.
He
no
will
bottom.
Do whatever he thinks he needs to do to win. And I think they'd mount a massive digital campaign.
I think you're right.
All the tools at their disposal to try and suppress support in the minority communities, in other communities where there might be resistance. So it certainly would test the premise. But I just don't know the answer. You know, if Buttigieg can navigate the primary process and get there, it may be a sign that you can overcome that. But that's the big question. You know, I think he's overcome the "you're a small town mayor" question. I think he's overcome the age question in a sense, mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. You know, if you stand on a stage with 11 of your peers who are running for president, including senators and a former vice president, and you can command that stage, as he did the other night, I think that was an answer to that question. But, you know, these other obstacles remain.
Yeah, just one last point. I sort of have in my mind, and tell me what you think about this, that politics has now become like this gigantic iceberg where there are the campaigns that you actually see, you know, the ones that are on television and the public debates and things that the pundits talk about. And then there is this subterranean politics that takes place on social media that can be absolutely toxic, can really be vile. And the fact is that we may not even know how extensive it is until very, very late in the game, or even after the election is over. You know what I'm talking about?
Or even what country the missiles are being launched from.
And yes, exactly. I mean, there's that, but there's also the way in which our politics has weaponized and empowered the worst people in
this
the
goes
world.
To a, yeah, you know? Well, this is the larger, there's a larger issue here, which is the rate at which technology is changing everything changing our economy and changing the way we communicate. And it's changing so rapidly that we as a society, we, democracies, can't get our arms around it fast enough. And, you know, one of the reasons we need wise, thoughtful leadership is we need to have a discussion nationally and globally about how we deal with these forces that are in the wrong hands, really weapons for destroying social comedy.
Yes, and because all of, unless we do that, everything that's happening that's bad will get worse. David Axelrod, thank you so much for spending so much
time with me. A pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
So who do you have on this weekend? Who's on your TV show?
Well, my TV show's once a month, so we did Harry Reid. We'll be doing another in November, not revealing the choice here. But I'll be talking to Admiral Mullen for my podcast, and this is really a propitious time to be sitting down with him. I'm sure he'll have some thoughts about where we are right now, particularly, by the way, the week after the president said that General Mattis was overrated. I think he'll have a few thoughts on that. I look forward to it. But listen, it's great to be with you. I could talk to you forever. And hopefully this is the first of many conversations.
I would love that. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.